welcome to a new episode of History and Politics, the Körber Stiftung's podcast that deals with the question of how and why history shapes the present. My name is Gabriele Wojdelko, and I'd like to warmly welcome Katja Heuer and Oliver Moody, who are hosting our special podcast series. Regular listeners might know it's a friendly takeover again. We had that last year, but now it's season number two of the new Germany. Germany after Russia's invasion in Ukraine. Germany 1 year after Die Zeitenwende. That's what Oliver and Katja deal with. And in the first episode of our series number two, they host special guest Alexei Yusupov. Enough said now, over to you, Katja and Oliver, let's get started.
Hello and welcome to The New Germany, a special podcast series brought to you by the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics Department.
Over the course of six episodes, we will explore the big questions hanging over Germany's past, present and future. Europe's largest nation-state is also one of its youngest and one of its most troubled. Can Germany come to terms with its history as it looks to build a better future?
If you're going through a potent sense of déjà vu at this point, don't worry. We all are. You have actually heard us ask these questions before. This is the first full season of The New Germany, following a few pilot episodes last year. And a new year may well be underway, but the world and your podcast hosts are still wondering, are we witnessing the emergence of the new Germany or just watching the old one have a midlife crisis?
Speaking of midlife crisis, I'm Katja Heuer, a German historian living in Britain.
And I'm Oliver Moody, a British journalist based in Berlin.
At the end of February 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine, we were told that a new era had dawned for Germany. The war seemed to have acted as a wake-up call for a giant that had just nodded off, really, in the absence of history. But rudely awakened by the sound of Russian missiles on Kyiv, Germany woke up, somewhat startled, and it wondered where it was. It blinked, it yawned, it stretched. What had happened? It had just rested its eyes a little bit after all the excitement of 1989 and 1990. What was it again? Europe, the world, history? It was all coming back. Suddenly, Germany was wide awake. It got up, full of good intentions, opened the windows, and told the world it was time for a
Zeitenwende.
And that
Zeitenwende,
or turning point, announced by Chancellor Olaf Scholz on the 27th of February 2022, seemed truly enormous in scale and nature. From making the military fighting fit to finding sustainable solutions to the energy crisis, Scholz's resolutions for the new Germany seemed even more ambitious, and a cynic might say, even more unrealistic than mine for 2023.
Do tell.
Tell what?
What were your New Year's resolutions?
Mine was actually to start learning Swedish.
Wow, that is unrealistic. Or have you started?
No, I've kept it so far. Till min förvåning. The pronunciation's pretty tough to deal with at first, but if you speak German, the grammar and the vocabulary are really not that bad. Can you guess what a Schnabel A might be?
No. I'm not even going to try and insult all the Swedes listening to this, so let's not.
So like Schnabel in German, it's a trunk. So it's an A with a trunk, which is the at symbol.
That is clever.
What was your resolution?
Well, I feel some like mine is somewhat mundane now compared to yours. I sort of felt having cooped myself up at home writing a book for 2 years, and it's felt like 10. I literally haven't seen the light of day for years, or that's what it feels like. So my very humble and hopefully doable New Year's resolution was to just get out more, quite literally, into the actual daylight outside. But we'll see whether I can stick to that this year.
I always knew you had an inner Wandervogel.
Wanderschnapp.
Quite. Well, let's see how Olaf Scholz is getting on with his resolution from last year, shall we? In this episode, we are going to look at an issue that is frequently overlooked when it comes to Germany's society. Minority groups in Germany who are often collectively referred to as Russian-speaking. There are, in fact, well over 2 million Russian native speakers in Germany. For people with Russian roots in Germany more widely, the estimates range between about 3 and 6 million, depending on who you listen to. But the first time many people outside of Germany became aware of this was when these very diverse communities came under scrutiny following Russia's invasion of Ukraine, despite the fact that many of them had been in the country for generations.
Yeah, I find that quite interesting myself. Coming from East Germany, I'm quite used to living, you know, sort of amongst and with people from Russia and from the former Soviet Union more widely. That includes, of course, Ukraine as well. It was, you know, normal. We had classmates who were from those regions, but spoke German and were, you know, sort of really quite integrated. And therefore, this was never a huge issue. And the first time I really started thinking about this kind of in the context of the war now was when I spoke to my former Russian teacher, actually, on the phone. And she said to me, oh, I really haven't got time to talk right now because I got to go and help my daughter-in-law look after some Ukrainian refugees. And I asked her a bit more about that. And it turned out that her daughter-in-law was actually from Russia, which I didn't know either, and had family in Russian-speaking family in Ukraine, who sort of literally just turned up on her doorstep and knocked on the door and said, you know, can we live with you for a while? And that kind of intertwining of the current situation with the different Russian-speaking minorities in Germany really actually got me thinking about it, whereas previously, you know, they were just part of society sort of more widely. But that got me thinking, really, who are those communities actually, when, why, and where from, really, did they come to Germany? Have they become Germanized, or were they, in fact, German to start with? How do they feel about the Russo-Ukrainian war? How does Russia, in turn, feel about them? So maybe let's start at the beginning. Why are there millions of people with Russian and Eastern European roots in Germany? Cool, that is a lot of questions, isn't it?
I have a question. Was that the word core there? Seriously, Katya, you're gonna be adding blimey governor next?
I'm tempted, but you know, come on, you've gone so native in Berlin yourself. I bet you have Brötchen with meat salad for breakfast.
Well, I'm sure, I imagine you know what a Metegel is.
Yes, I do know what a Metegel is.
Well, for the benefit of listeners who haven't yet had the pleasure, it's a hedgehog sculpted elegantly from raw mince. And then with the kind of finessing details added on with raw onion. And a few weeks ago, a friend of mine invited me round for a vegan Metegel made from pea protein. So that's how much of a Berliner I am by now.
Excellent. I'm very proud of you.
Right. I think we can dispense with this Anglo-German badinage before someone gets offended and get back to the bacon, as that famous Russian speaker Angela Merkel once said. Let's start by looking at who these Russian speakers actually are in Germany. Because in reality, a lot of them are neither Russian nationals nor necessarily that fluent in Russian. The group Germans are possibly most familiar with is the Russlanddeutsche, or the so-called Russia Germans. Really, these are people with ethnic German heritage, often going a long way back, whose families wound up in Russia or the Soviet Union, including the Soviet-occupied Baltic states.
Yeah, and this is in itself something that many people aren't familiar with. There are still Germans or people who consider themselves German in Russia today. So by 1989, when the Soviet Union was beginning to crumble and Germany was on the brink of reunification, there were still 2 million people in the Soviet Union who would have described themselves as German or of German origin. Whilst a lot of them then left, most of them actually going to Germany, 10 years later, there were still 600,000 or so there, some also in other countries such as Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Ukraine, and so on. And over the centuries, they had kind of gone there for various different reasons, some because they were encouraged to by people like Catherine the Great, for example, to come and help sort of modernize Russia. Others for economic reasons, land and so on and so forth. And if you want to find out a little bit more about why there were Germans in Russia to start with, you could also have a look at one of our previous episodes, episode 2 from last year, where we talked a little bit more about this connection between Germans and Russians, particularly Germans going to Russia.
In today's context, most of these people moved to Germany either shortly before, during, or after the collapse of the Soviet Union. And since this is Germany, there are inevitably quite legally specific terms for the different groups. Those who arrived before the end of 1992 were officially referred to as Aussiedler, or resettlers, and those who came after that cutoff point are known as Spätaussiedler, or late resettlers. The German government reckons a total of 4.6 million resettlers and late resettlers have arrived since 1950, although only about half of these actually came from the USSR or its successor states. The rest were from the other Warsaw Pact countries, which is mainly Poland, but also Romania, Czechoslovakia, and other states.
What I find quite interesting about that is that they have such a special status in the German immigration system, and I think also in German society. So kind of linking into what I was saying earlier about, you know, me not really being aware of people being of Eastern European origin as such, I think the same applies to some extent to the German state, which considers these people Germans. And therefore, rather than, you know, treating them as immigrants who have to go through a complicated process of paperwork in order to be able to live and work in Germany and eventually become naturalized citizens, it's much, much easier for the Aussiedler and the Spätaussiedler to do that simply because they are considered Germans who are basically coming back home, be that after several generations in some cases. And also sometimes they are actually the family members of these Russia Germans, so they might not necessarily even speak German or feel German themselves, and yet access to the kind of German system is much easier for them.
While I was doing the reading on this subject, I found a very interesting article in Der Spiegel magazine's archive from 1994 with the headline, Für jeden Ami ein Russe, for every Yank there's a Russian. And it's about a part of the Hunsrück Highlands in deepest Rhineland Palatinate, where at this point the armed forces are just moving out at the end of the Cold War. And the Russlanddeutsche, the Aussiedler and Spätaussiedler, are moving in with their, you know, their stuffed cabbage rolls and their herring salads and their very faint ancestral memories of Germany. And some of the locals say that they actually felt culturally closer to the departing Americans than to these ethnic Germans who are coming back. It's really a striking case study of this sense of mutual alienation and awkwardness on all sides. Further to what you just said, it's interesting that this scheme is based on a very old law, the Federal Law of Expelled Persons from 1953, which is actually drawn up in the first place to codify the rights of the Heimatvertriebene, the 12 or 14 million Germans who were driven out of Eastern Europe during the chaos that followed the end of the Second World War. And so it's regarded not so much as a tool for managing immigration, but as a tool for dealing with the consequences of the war, even sort of 50 or 60 or 70 years afterwards.
Oh, hang on a minute. I mean, how is it that in every single episode of the new Germany, we end up back in, well, you know, the old Germany? One minute we're talking modern immigration, and the next one it's the war again.
Oh, come on, Katja. Don't pretend you're completely innocent. If you're going to pretend you've pulled your mind out of the last century, I recommend you start with the one before that.
Oh, very droll. All right, then, let's just have one more thing from the past. One of the sort of more controversial parts of this law that determines whether you are indeed a resettler from Eastern Europe or Russia. So you basically, you're German based on a law that was passed for the first time in 1939, which is part of that old Germany that I was just talking about, which defined what the German folk or the German people was basically and who belonged to it and who didn't. And it was only very slightly amended, namely by taking a phrase out of it that basically said that people of foreign blood, and specifically Jews, weren't ever allowed to be German, regardless of whether or not they considered themselves German. And that was the only bit that was taken out. But otherwise, the kind of law, whether or not that decides whether or not you are German, is still based on this law from 1939.
Cor blimey, Governor. Right. Back to the present. There are, of course, several other groups of Russian speakers in Germany. One example is that from 1991 to 2005, nearly 220,000 Jewish people from the USSR and its various successors moved to Germany as so-called Kontingentflüchtlinge, or quota refugees, I guess you'd call that, who could bypass the usual asylum procedures. The rules got tightened up a bit, but the sort of core of that scheme is still there. There are a lot of Russian citizens who have no ethnic German heritage at all, who came to Germany through the various regular immigration routes, which include economic migrants, but also a lot of intellectuals, writers, and even opposition activists. And the newest category, and quite a large one, is, as you mentioned earlier, the Ukrainian war refugees who speak Russian. I haven't been able to find any even sort of approximate guesses, but if there are something like 1 million Ukrainians who've come to Germany since the start of the war, it seems entirely plausible that at least a couple of 100,000 would have some command of Russian. But, I mean, if there's one conclusion I draw from all of the above, it's that it doesn't seem like lumping these communities together purely on the basis of their linguistic abilities really doesn't tell you anything useful about identity, despite what the Kremlin might have you believe.
So, in other words, we've really not done much better than vast swathes of the German mainstream media here in trying to cover all of these groups in one go in one episode. But it's fascinating, really, how little awareness and nuance there seems to be in the debate around these really very diverse communities, given the scale of immigration from Eastern Europe and Russia, and how long this has been a pattern for. I reckon part of the problem is just the actual kind of nature of what is happening in Eastern and Central Europe. I think, I mean, I would say that as a historian, but I think people often lose sight of just how much of a demographic reshuffle has happened there over the last sort of two centuries or so with, you know, different, there we are again back in the 19th century, but also the 20th and the 21st, because there are no sort of natural boundaries, and the politics in Eastern and Central Europe have been so conflicted and hostile. You know, you have basically Germans, Poles, Russians, other Eastern European peoples, Jewish people, as you've just mentioned, all kind of relatively fluently moving backwards and forwards within that space. And I think after the Second World War, there's been an attempt really to try and fix borders and allocate states to the nations or the ethnicities that live in them. And that's sometimes pinned on language and sometimes it isn't. But that makes it incredibly complicated, and I think also incredibly sensitive as a topic, which is why I think so many people shy away from addressing it properly.
It's also worth pointing out that the picture's changed quite a bit over the last 20 years or so. For one thing, the number of late resettlers, those people with kind of deep German heritage coming back from what used to be the Soviet Union, has gone down quite sharply since the turn of the millennium. There were more than 98,000 new arrivals in 2001, but 5 years later, there were fewer than 8,000. In 2006. At the same time, the swirling sands of Europe's geopolitical mandala have brought in different groups of Russian speakers, especially those from new European Union member states, and also Russian nationals trying to get away from the Putin regime, and of course, some of the war refugees from Ukraine.
Wow. Brilliant. Now that we've muddied the waters completely, well, let's try and see if maybe our guest today can help us out here and put a little bit of clarity and structure into this debate. It's a good job we've got a true expert on the topic with us today who can help us sort these different groups into perhaps clearer categories so that we can talk about them in a bit more of a structured manner. There's so many different groups of Russian speakers in Germany while the country has taken sides in a conflict involving Russia. These communities have rightly received more media attention over the last year or so. But how much of this has been constructive? How has life changed for Russian-speaking people in Germany? And what, if anything, should be done to improve relations between the country and its Russian minorities?
We are fortunate to have a guest who is in an extremely good place to answer these important questions. Alexey Yusupov is the director of the Russia program for the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung and an expert on the Russian-speaking diaspora in Europe. Alexey, welcome.
Hi. Hi, good to be here.
Could you maybe start by telling us a little bit more about the Russian-speaking communities in Germany? In your view, can and should they even be defined by language? And maybe tell us a bit about what unites them and what divides them.
Right. I'll gladly do so. And I do feel that much more differentiation is needed, both for those who seek to understand the context, but also actually for the inner German discourse on those communities. And this is the right word to use here. It's a plural form because there are different groups of people with different backgrounds, with different migration experiences. they didn't really constitute a single space or single sphere. So mostly we use the term post-Soviet migration because it appears to be more accurate. And we're talking here about roughly 3.5 million people who have the so-called migration experience. This is a German legal term, meaning that either yourself or your parents have migrated to Germany. And as you see, the number is high, but indeed you need to drill down and see what does it actually mean in terms of language, identity, citizenship, and so on and so forth. The two biggest groups, those who are normally meant when people use the words Russian speakers, are the so-called Spätaussiedler, so this is something like late repatriates. This is by far the largest group. These are the actual in so-called Russian Germans. I'm very careful about this term in English because it seems to be even more confusing than in German. In German, it's Russlanddeutsche. So the Russian part of it is not an adjective. They are not Germans who are Russian, there are Germans from Russia. This is the idea of this term. And the Russia they're from is not the actual Russia from now, it's the historic Russia. It's actually Imperial Russia. So they can be from Ukraine, they can be from Moldova, they can be from Kazakhstan, but colloquially, they would be also called Russian Germans or late repatriates if you want to do it correctly. And you see that's a problem already because people who have spent their life in Ukraine and Kazakhstan don't necessarily are the right people to address any questions towards political loyalties when it comes to the current war and the conflict between Russia and Europe. So this is the biggest group, around 2.5 million with kids. It's more complicated to count. So those who are born in Germany, because the statistics, they are, the statistics are complicated to maintain because they are Germans at the moment of their arrival by citizenship. And this makes them a very privileged group of migrants. And this is also a source of a lot of, let's say, tension, because they are migrants, but at the same time, they are Germans. And they're Germans the moment they set foot on the soil of the Federal Republic. The second largest group is around 230,000 people, and it's the Jewish immigrants. And both of these groups, although they are migrants, are actually something very German in a way. So after reunification and in this time of normalization of relations between the two Germanys, but also the West German part and the Soviet Union, there was this idea that, well, the long 20th century is coming to an end. And it's a century of enormous upheaval and war and conflict. And Germany has been both the criminal and the victim. And so it's time to actually, deal with your own history and normalize things because the reunified Germany is a normal Germany. This is something you could read throughout, the time of Helmut Kohl. And so Germany opens up. It's actually quite rigid immigration system because Germany doesn't like to understand itself as a country made up of immigrants. It struggles with this idea as opposed to other European countries. It opens up to these two groups, the Jewish immigrants from the Soviet Union who are going out of the Soviet Union before and after the collapse of the USSR, and they go to Israel and they go to the US, but they also go to Germany. Germany is a significant part of that migration. I think it hosts around 25% of the people from the Jewish immigration of that time. And it opens up to its historic descendants, those late repatriates or Russian Germans who had spent their lives, and actually their parents and their great parents and their grandparents have not lived in the modern Germany. But especially in the Soviet Union, they had been victims of political repression based on their German identity. So they have been repressed, they've been deported, they have been persecuted. And this is why in this new, normal, reunified Germany, there is place for them. And this is the logic behind how these two groups come around. And this is the major part of the so-called Russian speakers communities. To finish it up, it has to be said that that's not all. There are so many more different groups. And again, as you can already see, the logic of their decision or opportunity to come to Germany, but also their interests and identities are very different. You have people from Ukraine. You have a lot of significant number also of refugee migration from the Caucasus, both inside Russia from Chechnya, but also from countries like Azerbaijan or Georgia. You have marriage migration, you have professional migration, you have educational migration, and all of these groups are also now somehow part of this larger idea of different Russian speaker groups in Germany.
Alexei, you mentioned just then how many of the Spätaussiedler had been alienated or persecuted under the Soviet Union. I'd like to expand on that a little bit. When you look at the Russian speakers in Germany who lived under the Soviet Union before 1991. Obviously, they're very far from being a monolithic group, but can you see any distinctive tendencies that mark them out? Does that experience of living under communism make a meaningful difference in your eyes?
Again, data is a little bit scarce, but some tendencies you could actually make out. And I think it's important to see that they are this weird mixture of migrants and natives now, right? So they're very privileged, as I said before, but at the same time, they are among the most common victims of racial prejudice and crime. And they're at the same time, they are one of the most common groups who are accused of racial violence or hate speech. So you have this weird thing of being in between. And this is the main paradox here. The expectation towards the Spätaussiedler was that they migrate, they get the German passport, and they just integrate it. Some time passes and you'll never see them again. And actually, for many of those people, it works. You wouldn't be able, if your ear isn't really good in getting hints of accents, you wouldn't be able to see differences. I mean, it's a white group, mostly. They are either secular or Christian. So actually, they're at the very top of the social hierarchy. And they get the citizenship, as I told you. At the same time, there is a lot of alienation going on here. And this alienation is specifically seen in electoral terms, I would say. So, or at least this is the indication how we can see what's going on. If you look at Eastern Germany, where there are a lot of Russian Germans or Spätaussiedler, you see that the post-Soviet nostalgia might actually facilitate some kind of a joint post-socialist nostalgia identity with some of the East Germans. So this idea that life has been good before, that you are in a way a loser of opening up, of the end of the socialist camp, that your elites do not really represent you, and so on and so forth. So things we can see in the German population, but you are also shared by this experience of life in Soviet Union. You see that there as well. On the other hand, and this is, I think, fascinating, the generation which has actually lived itself in the Soviet Union and migrated to Germany during their lifespan are much more, and you can see it in the polls, critical towards Russia, current Russia, as their kids. So in the next generation, and this is common for migrant groups, you find that if there is no acceptance and then there is experience of not being actually accepted as someone who is part of the, you know, native normal population, some people start to go back and look for their roots. And inside the Spätaussiedler, some scientists, some social scholars make up different groups on this spectrum of how well do people feel at home here. And very roughly, it's three stages. So there are the so-called, and these are titles and terms from the respondents themselves, so I don't make them up. It's the real Germans, people who probably came early in the 80s already, before the collapse, who have maintained or had maintained the German identity throughout the life of their families and communities in the Soviet Union. Very often they are also structured by common creed and religion, Baptist church, Mennonite church, other free churches. So the moment they came to Germany, that's it. They are German Germans, and only if you know their family history and know them intimately, personally, you would know that they are Spätaussiedler. Then you have probably the largest group of the so-called, well, those are the Russian Germans. They are in-betweeners. They speak German fluently. They are successful in their education and their job market. And actually, the indicators of how well people do over the course of their life in Germany are quite impressive. It's a success story. They have businesses. They expand. They work. They start families and so on and so forth. But they do maintain Russian at least at home. And they do have personal connections to Ukraine, Kazakhstan, Russia whatsoever, to their schoolmates, to their relatives and so on. This is the largest group. And I think the potential split goes through this group. And then you have the so-called, well, German Russians would be the term, I guess, or Rusaki. So people who, well, mostly young people who, as I hinted before, struggle with containing two cultures in themselves. And it's a high probability you would see them, you know, wearing state symbols of the Russian Federation or glorifying the Soviet Union, and also maybe even in a cliche way, over-exaggerating some stereotypes about Russianness. This is also part of the Spätaussiedler, but it's not all of them. It's one part of the different stage. And so depending on what your standing is and how successful you've been and how receiving and welcoming your experience in Germany have been, you probably would fall into one of these three groups.
Since the Russian invasion of Ukraine last year, there have been sporadic outpourings of pro-Kremlin sentiment in Germany, ranging from people putting Z symbols on their cars to demonstrations involving sometimes a few thousand people in the city centres. What do we know about who is organising this movement?
Well, indeed, there has been some public activity with clear pro-Kremlin stance. I was very unhappy that most of the German press called those pro-Russian demonstrations, because again, it simplifies things in a not constructive way. I would call it pro-Kremlin in a way. There haven't been too many, to be honest. I was surprised that there hasn't been more. So there is this one, how do you say, autocause or so. It's a one time there was a demonstration with cars going from Cologne to Bonn, and then there was this car run in Berlin. But if you look at the numbers, it's hundreds of people, up to 1,000 surely, but this is the magnitude of how many actually participate. And this is just a minuscule number given the overall number of the people we're talking about here, right? So it's important to see that although they are very loud and very present, also seen in the press, they are occupying a space which is empty otherwise, because all of the other representatives of the Russian-speaking communities are not acting in the same political way. And there are good reasons for that. We can discuss later if it's of interest. But for those two demonstrations, there is quite credible, and I think I'm not an investigative journalist, but I've spoken to some and there has been some good research, that it's organized by NGOs and organizations who have a German background but are commonly involved in projects associated with the Russian diplomatic presence here, be it the embassy, be it the Rossatrudnicheство, which is a governmental agency which is supposed to stimulate international cooperation. And they have areas. So some of those NGOs are lobbying for specific educational policies, especially for Russian schools, Russian-speaking schools. Some of them are, and this is, I think, where a lot of those Z or Z activists come from, is politics of memory. So they're taking care of old Soviet graves, and they engage in public actions for the 9th of May, which is the official victory day in the Russian Federation. And there is proof, you can find it online, that they have been engaged with official Russian institutions in the past. I haven't seen proof for the current demonstrations that they have been paid for or organized for, but frankly, it's not that important, because the rhetoric and the symbols and the whole messaging which is radiating from those events is so in sync with the Russian governmental rhetorics that it's absolutely clear that they are, at the very least, they are very useful to Russian foreign policy, and maybe there has actually been cases of cooperation or financing these things.
And linking into this, Alexei, in terms of the way that Russia perceives these minority groups in Germany, obviously, you know, the situation is sort of heightened by the war in Ukraine. But in general, what's Russia's position towards these so-called Russian-speaking communities in Germany?
I feel that, like in the past, before the war, it has been mostly cooptation. So even if you look at the Russian numbers, now I've cited some numbers from how Germany calculates the number of people who are either members of those communities or Russian speakers. The Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs claims that there are 6 million of Russian speakers in Germany, and this is highly manipulative because they don't really explain, does it mean mother tongue level? Does it mean second language? Does it mean maybe it's Germans who use Russian? They just say, you know, 6 million of people in Germany are Russian speakers. And this is why this term is also sometimes not so helpful. They conflate it with the notion of all of those who speak Russian are in a way countrymen and countrywomen. And thereby, there is a special obligation and special link and a special obligation by the Russian Federation to look after them. And the most prominent case of how this manipulative politics have played out was 2016. It's a very famous case of Mädchen Lisa, girl named Lisa, where a fake story of rape, which never happened, has been spread around also in the social media, and there were demonstrations on the streets and so on and so forth. For me, actually, the case, or the fact that there hasn't been a repetition of this throughout the first year of the Russian-Ukrainian war, although there have been attempts. So we've seen that there are stories in the social media of fake witnesses saying there was a woman claiming that she saw a Russian young man stabbed by Ukrainian refugees, and also tried to make fuss about of it and start a social media shitstorm. We've seen that that doesn't work anymore. So it hasn't been repeated. And my understanding is that it hasn't been repeated because the experience of being manipulated has been very negative for many of those people in between the worlds that I have mentioned. Surely the authorities have gotten better as well, the German authorities, of countering these ideas, but we haven't seen any successful cases of that. So I guess in the past, the Russian stance was to co-opt and maybe to let them be manipulated to manipulate. At the moment, it's quite passive because I feel that there is no coherent strategy of what to do. And also, it's not a priority at the moment. And the speculation that the German society will be shaken by social unrest much more than identity-based unrest. So given the inflation and the energy prices and so on, this might have been the main strategy of Moscow. And since it hasn't materialized, I guess there might be a strategy shift. But at the moment, I don't see any significant activity on this front.
Since the bombings of the Nord Stream pipelines in the Baltic Sea and the sabotage, apparent sabotage, I should say, of a fairly large part of the North German railway network, there's been some speculation in the German public sphere that Russian speakers in the country may in some way be a kind of reservoir with a heightened susceptibility to sort of being spies or saboteurs or fifth columnists for the Putin regime. To what extent do you think that is just classic wartime paranoia? Or to what extent are the sort of domestic intelligence agencies potentially justified in looking at some of these communities a little bit more closely than other people in Germany?
I feel this underestimates the other instruments, you know, Russian foreign policy and, you know, intelligence agencies have in Germany. So this espionage cases we've had so far, those are German public officials. The recent one where quite a high-ranking official of the BND has been found out to be a Russian spy. Well, he doesn't need to be a Spätaussiedler or a Soviet Jew to do espionage for Moscow. And this is why I feel this case that, you know, this community, so this part of your population are a potential threat, it lacks plausibility for me. There is nothing special to be won for Moscow and for Russia from going specifically into this direction. Also, it has to be mentioned that, again, as I mentioned, many of those people have made successful careers and are fully integrated also in the public services. There is a very significant number of people in police and the army and the intelligence. Of course, you could say, well, this is the opening for potential traitors and spies. But on the other hand, this is also a huge reservoir of expertise for the German state to be able to navigate attempts of manipulation. And my general impression is that the knowledge of intricacies and complexities of the German society is not there on the side of Moscow state agencies. I mean, we've all seen how they miscalculated about Ukraine when it comes to how does this society work. It's the same in Germany. It's a complex, multi-layered, very complicated society. And I feel that trying to manipulate it in a way of stirring unrest is just not going to work. And so when it comes to the German discourse, you do have some fear-mongering saying, look, aren't we very vulnerable? But I don't feel those are mainstream voices. And sometimes you do read the one or other article in text, and you do see the one or other article or movie where you see, well, this is just unsubstantiated. And this is the problem, that this part of the German society, it's successful. It was successful and is successful because it's mostly invisible. But because it's invisible, the knowledge in the general audience and the public is quite low about how the post-Soviet migration has worked and how Russian speakers actually operate and live and, you know, just get around and get along in Germany. So I don't think it's an actual very promising avenue for Moscow to exploit.
And even from the brief discussion we just had on this topic, I think it's apparent that the war in Ukraine has put these so-called Russian-speaking minorities in Germany in quite an awkward position. It's constantly expected of them that they have an opinion on the war that they, depending on who's asking, either kind of profusely distance themselves from Putin's ideas or endorse them, but certainly it's expected of them to position themselves. Can you tell us a bit more about how the situation for Russian speakers in Germany has changed since February 2022?
Right, that's an interesting topic. I feel, again, a couple of things to get straight first. Most of the Spätaussiedler, the so-called Russian Germans, are not from the Russian Federation. If you add up the numbers from Kazakhstan and Ukraine, then they are the majority. So I feel it has to be pronounced to be able to explain that, of course, they don't feel addressed when there is a call for the so-called Russian Germans to position themselves. Why should they? They have never lived in modern Russia. Second of all, the Jewish community, the post-Soviet Jewish community, is, I think, affected in the most destructive way by this, or maybe in the most tragic, because there it's comparable how many people are from Russia and how many people are from Ukraine. And it tears them apart. I know of synagogues and communities who have canceled a lot of social events throughout 2022 because they had fear of not managing well with members of their communities originating from two different sides of this war. And they have decided to try to depoliticize. So it goes straight throughout communities and it goes straight through families. And this is something I've hinted at before, but I want to maybe stress it again. Depending on your generation and age and your experience, you might live in a family where the old generation are Putinists and the younger generation are completely integrated German, European young people. And we've known there is some data showing that the amount of inner conflict in families of Russian speakers, this is where the actual heat and pressure is on. And this is a problem for these people, of course. In the public sphere, indeed, I feel that it has actually contributed, the war and the Russian aggression has contributed to this slow erosion of a common Soviet slash Russian slash Russian speaking identity. So in the past, you've had some symbols where everyone was at least okay with being the silhouette of the Kremlin on your milk product, be it the name of your supermarket, be it, you know, the name of the largest Russian-speaking, Russian-language newspaper was Ruskaya Germania, Russian Germany, or of the most popular Russian-speaking, actually, music radio station in Berlin was Ruskaya Berlin, Russian Berlin. They've all have renamed themselves. They have banned Russian from their names because their reality is that it's not being from Russia that made them the way they are, but it's the language and it's the common memory of some shared culture. And indeed, the Soviet Union, especially the late Soviet Union, after it stopped to be a totalitarian regime under Stalin and has transformed into a more authoritarian form, it has allowed for a huge cultural sphere to exist and to flourish. So older people who are still aware of that time and still remember, they are those who now, I guess, experiencing the falling apart of this post-Soviet identity acutely, very acutely. For the younger ones, it doesn't really matter because they've managed to have other identities and they manage to be in between and they know that, you know, what is right and that support for Ukraine is the right thing at the moment and that there is no contradiction between speaking German. And again, we haven't spoken about this, but if you talk about Russian speakers, then a very significant number of those are from Ukraine. And at the moment, chances are if you're in Berlin and you're in a supermarket and you hear people speak Russian, that there are Ukrainian refugees. So I feel that this idea that the Russian language, Russian culture is a continuation of an official culture of the Russian Federation is fading away. And actually, that might be a good thing because it gives a chance that there will be something which we in the future we could call a European Russian culture, you know. So, and also even the federal government tries to institute a space with funding to showcase Russian speaking content, be it music, be it literature, be it something else, which is not from Russia. It is in Russia, but it's from Germany. And this is how I see the trend at the moment.
I find it interesting how many things, you know, you sort of had to clarify and set straight. And as somebody that grew up in Germany and in East Germany as well, where a lot of these communities are, I feel that there's been a surprisingly kind of little amount of coverage of these and discussion around these minorities compared to other immigrants to Germany, where debates have been very public, very heated, very protracted. there has been very little kind of bandwidth given in the media, I feel, and in public debate to these minorities. Why do you think they've received so little attention in the past? And do you feel that that should change? There should be more debate around it.
Well, I certainly wish that there would be more coverage, more nuance, more differentiation. I see some positive things happening. I see, you know, there are some podcasts and shows, especially in the public German television, where I think, why am I seeing it now? And why is it hasn't been there in the last 20 years? But indeed, this is the paradox. The paradox is that obviously these are migrants, but at the same time, the mainstream German society has cataloged them as non-migrants. And the paradox is that the more successful you are as a migrant group in integrating, the less probably obvious is the struggle you're having. So in a way, people from post-Soviet Russian-speaking communities are victims of their relative success. And especially speaking about Eastern Germany, you do have a problem with coverage for even Eastern Germany, East Germany in the mainstream media. This is a big topic. And so if you, I mean, often I explain to people that, you know, the most common migrant group in Magdeburg so is probably Russian speaking. So it's not Turkish, it's not Polish, but these are the images of the overall migration in Germany. It's thought in terms of Turkey and Poland and Arab states and so on. And it's a Western German discourse. So people who have come in an attempt of Helmut Kohl's reunified Germany to normalize itself have been received, and then the mainstream public, the mainstream audience just forgot about them. And they only remember when there is a case like this girl Lisa or those pro-Kremlin demonstrations, which do not serve justice both to the majority, the vast majority of the people from Russian-speaking minorities or Russian-speaking groups, nor does it really represent any real social process. It's very, very marginal. So I guess it's a dangerous thing. On the one hand, there is now coverage more because there is a heightened sense of and a securitized sense of, are we as a society in Germany prepared for a prolonged conflict and a proxy war with Russia? On the other hand, that makes differentiation more difficult, because if it's securitized, it's always in terms of, is it a threat? If it is a threat, how are we going to handle it? And so on. So I'm also not decided yet either it's a good thing or a bad thing that there is more coverage now, because sometimes this coverage is very simplified. But at the end, and I feel that this might be the positive outlook, that Zeitenwende and this whole idea that Germany needs to gear up and prepare itself for realities of the century means that you need to take a proper look at your own society, and if your homework is done, and if societal resilience is part of being a country which can maintain its own stability and withstand aggression. I hope that if the conversation goes this way, there will be more bandwidth and more space to differentiate without, you know, losing attention, which sometimes is a risk.
With great reluctance, I think we're going to have to wrap up here, but you've concluded it beautifully there. Alexei, this has been fascinating, particularly on the misperceptions and some of the very large holes in public understanding of this issue, particularly since, as you say, it's going to be very important for Germany's societal resilience going forward. If our listeners would like to find out more about Alexei's work, he is active on LinkedIn and Twitter, and on his personal website, www.alexyus.de. And if you read German, I also recommend having a look at some of the reports from Alexei and his colleagues on the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung's Russia program.
Yeah, I'd like to echo Oliver's words there. It's been absolutely fascinating and a pleasure talking to you. I think some of these myths that you've helped dispel there will hopefully help move the discussion and public awareness of this really important issue onwards. So thank you very much for coming on the New Germany podcast.
Gladly. Thank you for having me.
And that, dear listeners, concludes this episode of the New Germany podcast. We hope you've enjoyed having our ramblings back in your ears as you commute to work, do the washing up, or run along the road at such an early hour that it makes everybody else feel like a lazy toad.
Possibly more of an insight into your tormented Protestant work ethic than into the lives of our listeners, Katja. But yeah, it's nice to be back talking about the issues that keep Olaf Scholz awake at night. If you too would like to stay awake a little longer, Pondering Germany's Problems Present and Past, you can find this and all other episodes of the Körber Stiftung's History and Politics podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or any other good purveyor of podcasts.
We hope you'll join us again for the next episode, where we will launch another attempt to solve Germany's problems.
Or at least try not to make them any worse.
Right, bis zum nächsten Mal.
Goodbye.